My name is Joseph Kershek, and I do represent Roy and Helene Thorpe. They are the plaintiff appellant petitioners in this case, and they're also present in court. And as you know from reading the briefs, this case deals with issues involving the rezoning of the Thorpe farmland located in the town of Lebanon. They own 255 acres of land, and their request was to rezone approximately 165 acres of that land. Before I get involved in a great detailed statement of facts, I'd like to point out to you what I see as probably one of the largest errors that was made by the Court of Appeals in its second decision in this case. And that error is this. I think the court erred in finding that the Thorpes had not filed a writ of certiorari, and as a result of that, they waived any of their state law remedies. I say that because, as we pointed out in our brief, the case of Tobler versus Door County specifically has stated that you no longer need the magic language of writ of certiorari. You no longer need the use of a extraordinary writ to seek a circuit court review of zoning issues and zoning decisions. The Thorpes had done that. They filed a summons and complaint, and in the summons and complaint, they did state common law remedies that would normally be reviewed by a trial court under a writ of certiorari. And if you look at the wherefore clause of our complaint, you will see that we are asking for some state law remedies along the guidelines of seeking a declaratory review by the court under 806.04, finding that because of the method and manner in which the town of Lebanon and Dodge County had passed the zoning ordinances, and subsequently Dodge County denying the Thorpes their right to rezone their property back to the way it was for 20 years prior to the involvement of these municipalities, the zoning ordinances should be rendered null and void.
Are you abandoning your argument, which I thought was your first argument with respect to this, that the writ of certiorari was not available to you because there was no Board of Adjustment?
No, we're not. If you look at Chapter 59, it does start out Board of Adjustments, and under Section 59, I believe, 69.694 parent 10, it does speak of a Board of Adjustment, and I wanted to point out to the court that the Dodge County did not have a Board of Adjustment. But the point is that our complaint can and should be construed as a request for a writ. Even under 59.69, parent 14, a landowner can seek a review of a county zoning ordinance, provided it's filed within 180 days, which this particular complaint was.
I'm sorry, what's that question?
What are you citing? 59.69, parent 14, and it was referred in... I think at least the brief for Dodge County. But I think it's important to note that in our wherefore clause, we did ask for not only a declaratory review, but we also asked for a finding of the court that the ordinances be rendered null and void, and we asked for an injunction, which is another state remedy. We asked for an injunction to stop the enforcement of these ordinances as they relate to the Thorpes. But on the, along with... that, we also were pursuing as part of our complaint the constitutional violations. And the one constitutional violation dealt with the Thorpes being denied their due process rights. And the gist of that claim is, as pointed out by the Court of Appeals, due process under that guarantee, substantive due process guarantee, protects people like the Thorpes from and against the exercise of power by the government without any reasonable justification in the service of a legitimate governmental objective. We point out in our...
Can I go back just a moment?
Sure.
I'm getting confused between the arguments that you're making based upon constitutional claims and those that might still be available to you as a matter of state claim. Aren't matters such as injunction and all that still available to you?
Well, number one, what bothers me is that there was a comment in the second appellate court decision in this case that they were no longer available to us. I think they are still longer available to us. The opposing counsel keeps arguing that they're not available to us because of the notice requirements under 93.80. And we never waived, the folks never waived their right to state law claims.
So what are the state law claims that you believe are still pending or that you still have available to
them? The state law claims would be this. We would have a right to seek a ruling from the court, call it a writ, or call it a declaratory review, that the method and manner in which Dodge County and the town of Lebanon adopted the ordinances, specifically one by not reviewing the ordinance rezoning with the five-member committee as required by statute, and the fact that it was a blanket rezoning, which is disfavored in this state by the case of Hobart versus Carrier, that at least under those theories, we are entitled to void the zoning. And as a result of that, it does not apply to the Thorpes. I think we're also entitled to a ruling by the court that we're entitled to an injunction to prohibit the enforcement of those ordinances against the Thorpes because of the method and manner in which they were passed.
Yes. Are there others? I didn't mean to cut you.
Well, I think that you probably know from reading our brief that we had an incredible experience on the Dodge County Board floor, and that is when we had a vote 4-1 in the Dodge County Plan Commission.
What state claim is involved there?
Well, I don't, under Maris versus the city of Cedarburg, I don't think that the Thorpes ever had an impartial and fair hearing. Under that case, the county board is supposed to be a fact finder, and they're supposed to determine the facts in the case and apply them to the ordinances. They didn't do that. There was a lot of discussion on the board level about the Thorpes being developers, having ulterior motives to develop their land, and that just strictly wasn't true. In addition to that, there was a misrepresentation of the Plan Commission vote, which caused mass confusion among the board members when there was a discussion about whether the Thorpes zoning request should be passed.
All that aside, and not aside, but assuming all that is true, isn't it a basic principle of pursuit of a due process claim that there must be inadequate state remedies, and yet you've just ticked off three or four state remedies that appear to be adequate, assuming you can get past the notice problem?
Okay. The appellate court has found, and the opposing counsel have also argued, that part of our claims are Section 19.3 actions, in that we were deprived rights by the government. Now, along with the Section 1983 actions, is the requirement under the Felder case and one or two other cases we cite, that you cannot impose state remedies and you cannot, on people like the Thorpes, who are pursuing both constitutional claims and a writ of certiorari, and nor can you impose exhaustion of governmental steps. So to that extent, I think that they're not mutually exclusive. I think that the Thorpes could argue their state law claims and at the same time pursue their constitutional right violations.
Well, the Court of Appeals, of course, said you could pursue your equal protection.
That's correct, and we're not arguing that, obviously. But it seems like every time we appear before the trial court, our case gets dismissed. And part of the problem, and part of the problem we have is I don't know if the trial court ever read our complaint, because if it had read a wherefore clause, it would have realized that we still have the right to pursue state law claims, and we would still like that right. Now, each time we appeared before the trial court, we got involved in this notice requirement, and I'd like to address that briefly. If we have the right to pursue our federal law claims, call them Section 1983 claims or otherwise, we shouldn't be bound by the notice statutes in the state of Wisconsin because the federal law trumped those. Now, so that leaves us with the state law claims. Now, we shouldn't have to abide by the notice requirements to pursue our state law claims because we have a recent appellate court decision, which is Kapschke versus, I think it was Woolworth County. And that decision basically held that when there is a proceeding that is similar to a writ of certiorari, which is like the one we have here for the Thorpes, the notice requirements under Section 893.60 do not apply. And the reason they don't apply, one of the reasons they don't apply, is because we're not starting a new action. We're not commencing a new action where a municipality may be at a disadvantage because they've never had an opportunity to investigate the facts and circumstances in the case. What we're really doing under our writ of certiorari, we're asking for a review, and only a review. We're not bringing a new claim. We're not raising any new issues. So whether we're pursuing federal law claims, whether we're pursuing state law claims, the notice requirements just don't apply. And that's something the trial court...
If they do, have you met them?
Yes, we have. And we met them, number one, because there is a letter that I've attached to our appendix, and the letter basically was a letter that was authored by the Thorpe's attorneys, namely myself, and it's a letter dated November of 1994. And that letter was sent out within the 120 days after Dodge County passed their final zoning ordinance, adopting, at the town's request, the revised zoning map that affected the town. Now, in addition to that, even if you don't think that letter met the statutory requirements of notice of injury and notice of claim, the other exception to that statute is that if the municipalities had actual notice and were not prejudiced, there is still no requirement of a notice, an official notice. Now, I say that there was actual notice because both the town of Lebanon and Dodge County was involved with the Thorpes at every stage of the game. As soon as the Thorpes saw that the Dodge County passed their revised zoning ordinance, they petitioned the town plan commission, they petitioned the town board, and they got their zoning corrected. Then they exhausted further remedies by petitioning the Dodge County plan commission, who voted in favor of the Thorpes, and then they took the next step and they petitioned Dodge County Board of Supervisors, where we had the unpleasant experience. So to that extent, I don't think that either municipality could argue lack of notice, nor could they argue any type of prejudice, because they've been involved in this case every step of the way. And we've attached portions to our brief, our appendix, of the depositions that were taken of the town board chairman, Betty Balian. We've attached the deposition of Robert Sharp, who was the corporation counsel at the time. Both indicated that they were fully aware of the issues when they got my letter of November 1994. They had opportunity to discuss the issues among themselves. They had an opportunity to discuss the issues with their counsel, and Ralph Sharp even testified that he had an opportunity to do legal research on the issues. So I don't know how either municipality could claim either lack of actual notice or prejudice.
Why do you think the Court of Appeals ignored that issue?
That's a good question. I don't know why the Court of Appeals sort of left us hanging there, not really deciding the notice issue. I think they felt that because the Thorpes had not filed the writ of certiorari, maybe it was a moot point. As I argued before, I think the summons and complaint of the Thorpes can be construed as a writ of certiorari.
Why didn't you ask the Circuit Court to do so then and proceed in that way? Because the writ of certiorari standard of review encompasses all of the arguments, constitutional and otherwise, that you're making in this case.
We had discussions on the trial court level about the meaning of the first court of appeals decision. And part of the discussions when we got to the trial court level dealt with whether the Thorpes failed to comply with the Wisconsin notice statutes again. And as if they did, then the Thorpes could not bring any state remedies because they could not now rely on federal law or constitutional provisions. Now, we tried to argue on the trial court level that it misinterpreted the first appellate court decision, but we weren't successful. And we tried to argue that we were entitled to bring both constitutional claims and state claims despite the notice statutes. The court just felt that we did not meet the standard of the notice statutes and dismissed our case.
But that doesn't answer my question. Why didn't you just say to the trial court when the first motions to dismiss were filed, Judge, construe this as a summons and complaint for the remedy available by certiorari, which is what you could have done, right, under the case law, even though there's no statutory certiorari available under these circumstances, and have the court proceed in that way, and that standard of review would have encompassed each and every one of the arguments you're making in this case, and we wouldn't have all these thorny issues in front of us.
Right. You're talking about the first time the Thorpe's case was dismissed?
I'm talking about any time.
Well, okay.
Any time in this case you're in front of the trial court judge, we can avoid all of these thorny, difficult procedural issues if you just construe this as a petition for a writ of certiorari, call up the record from the administrative agencies below, and let's have it out under the certiorari standard of review, which by its terms incorporates all of the arguments you're making about arbitrary and capriciousness, not in conformance with a proper standard of law, etc., etc.
To answer your question, on the first motion where the Thorpe's case was dismissed, the real issue before it was more notice claims, the fact that the Thorpe's didn't comply with the notice claims, than it was as to whether or not they were pursuing state or federal remedies. Now, it seemed like the trial court was on one level, but when it got to the appellate court level, it was a different type of level, and it didn't. The arguments we made on the trial court level were a little different than how the appellate court level interpreted them. But see, some of these arguments were made.
Did you say to the trial court, Judge, we don't have to give notice. This is a certiorari action. Consider it as such, even though it's not on the caption.
The emphasis,
which is basically the argument that you're making here.
The emphasis on the first motion was strictly notice as it related to federal claims.
Which is clearly not required under federal
versus. Right, but for some reason the trial court had a problem with that. Okay, and then we had it, and then we went up to the appellate court, and they construed our complaint to contain federal law violations and constitutional law violations, and then it went back down, and then here we thought we could still pursue our state law remedies, and another motion was brought, and at that time the court held that the Thorpe's failed to comply with the Wisconsin notice statutes. They can't rely upon federal law or constitutional protections due to the fact that there were adequate state remedies which no longer were available to the Thorpe's because they hadn't complied with the notice statute. So we were in a catch-22 situation with the trial court, I felt. And we tried to argue that they misinterpreted the first Court of Appeals decision, and I tried to, you'll see in the transcript, I tried to query the judge near the end of that motion hearing as to what he felt the Thorpe's state remedies were that he was dismissing because we didn't comply with the notice statute. And he basically referred to the appellate court decision.
Well, isn't it up to you to make it clear what remedy you're pursuing?
I believe it is.
I guess that's what my question goes to.
We tried. We tried on both of the trial court levels and both of the hearings. And we did argue both federal claims. We argued...
Did you argue that this was in actuality a certiorari review?
We argued that state remedies were involved.
What state remedies? Available by certiorari? That's a remedy.
Right. And if you look at the trial court briefs, we pointed out that in our wherefore clause, we were asking for an injunction. We were asking for a declaratory right under the statutes, which are akin to writs of certiorari. They're state court reviews.
No, a writ of certiorari is a request for the agency below to send up the record for judicial review. And I think this whole thing could have been avoided if you had identified your claim correctly. And it seems to me that your argument here today essentially admits that. You're saying, this is a certiorari all along.
Right. But
and that's what we should consider it as, or it's a constructive certiorari.
It's a constructive certiorari. There was no use of the magic language, writ of certiorari, in the complaint. But the complaint is akin to a writ of certiorari. When I drafted it, and you look at the statutes...
Apparently nobody recognized it as such, including yourself, because you never identified it that way in any of the opportunities you had to do so in front of the trial court.
Well, we did point it out that we were there seeking a circuit court review of what the town and the county did. That is akin to a writ of certiorari. A writ of certiorari is a review. So I hope that answers your question.
What your state law claim is?
Our state law claim? Well, number one, we're asking the trial court to review what the county and the town did and the method and manner in which they passed the ordinance, the zoning ordinance.
Is that contrary to a statute or contrary to the state constitution?
Well, we point out in our complaint that in adopting an ordinance for the rezoning of its land, the town of Lebanon was required under 60.61 paren 4 of the Wisconsin statutes to appoint a town zoning committee consisting of 5 members. They did not. And it's interesting to note that there was no affidavits filed at the trial court level when there's a motion for summary judgment indicating they did. We are also asking the court to review this as a state law claim under the 80604 as far as the declaratory judgment goes, because at the time we appeared before Dodge County Board of Supervisors and the Plan Commission, we had filed numerous documents in support of our position for rezoning. We had an affidavit from 4 farmers that indicated that they had tilled the soil and it was not suitable for agricultural purposes. We had a report from an engineering company indicating that the soils were not suitable for agricultural purposes. We had an affidavit from 65 neighbors of the Thorpes indicating that they had no objections to their request for rezoning. We had other maps showing that the town actually took wetlands, they actually took a floodplain land, and they zoned it general agricultural. So that was one of the things we were asking the trial court to review as part of its declaratory judgment that the county acted improperly when it did not grant the Thorpes request.
And is that a denial of due process, then, you're saying? What was that argument?
Well, it's the process that took place both on the town and county level that we are asking the court to review. It's sort of a due process claim. It's sort of a review, as I said, under Maris versus City of Cedarburg, where an individual like the Thorpes are entitled to a fair and impartial hearing, and there has to be a fact-finding process, which there wasn't in this particular case. And not one person on the county board level, when this matter came up for discussion, mentioned any of this in support of the Thorpes. To the contrary, the Thorpes were characterized as developers with ulterior motives who wanted to somehow develop their land. So we wanted the circuit court to review that as part of our state law claim. And if the court agreed with us, another part of our state law claim, we were going to ask it to issue an injunction to stop the enforcement of these ordinances as they related to the Thorpes.
And why would an injunction be issued? What's the basis of the argument?
Well, if the court found that Section 60.61 paren 4 had been violated, I think the court would have authority to issue an injunction because the town failed to comply with the state statutes in adopting zoning ordinances. If the court found that maybe the requirements under Maris versus City of Cedarburg were violated, the court could also issue an injunction and stop the enforcement of this action. I think under a writ, the court has other powers, and they could have held because of the method and manner in which the zoning ordinance was adopted, that maybe the town regroup and relook at the ordinance, and as well as the county. So that's part of our claims.
So what kind of opinion do you want from this court?
Here's what I'd like this court to do. I'd like this court to first define that the Thorpes have not waived their state law claims and their state law remedies, number one. Secondly, I'd like to, this court to find that the Thorpes still are entitled to pursue their substantive due process claims and their procedural due process claims. And I'd like you to find that because of the nature of their state claims, because of the nature of their federal claims, the notice requirements under 893.60 do not apply to them, so we don't get bogged down in this every time we go to the trial court.
You also, I presume, want us to allow you to continue your equal protection claim.
Right. I'd also like you to pursue my equal protection claim.
And your procedural due process. Maybe not.
Yes, correct.
Once procedural, okay.
I thought I said that, I'm sorry. Procedural due process, substantive due process, and our equal protection.
But if we say that notice is actually given, at least constructive notice, and there was no prejudice, then we need not address that last one that you mentioned, right?
Which? Do we have to give notice under 63.90 or 80? Excuse me, yes. Under either state law claims or federal law claims, I don't think that the Thorpes will be required to give notice. Thank you. It appears my time is up.
Don't we need to make fact-finding on whether or not the county and town had actual notice, and whether, assuming that they did, and whether, assuming it didn't formally comply with the notice statute, whether there was any prejudice? Do you think we need any fact-finding?
No, I do not. And let me tell you why I say that. As far as the state law claims go, under the case of Kapischke versus County of Walworth, which is a 1999 decision, the court specifically held that when you have a claim for writ of certiorari, where someone is pursuing state law claims asking for a review of zoning decisions, the notice requirements do not apply. Okay. And as far as the federal claims go, the notice requirements would not apply under the Felder case, in several cases that were decided since then.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes to rebuttal. Mr. McAndrew, you're splitting your time. Okay. Mr. McAndrew, you are arguing first for the county. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Scott McAndrew, and I represent Dodge County. I won't spend any time going through the factual allegations, at least at the outset here. I think the court is fairly well aware of the factual allegations in the plaintiff's complaint. I will take a little bit of time to address the previous appeal and the application of 893.80 in the context of this case. First motion for summary judgment in this case was a motion to dismiss the complaint on the grounds that the plaintiffs had not complied with the two subdivisions of Section 893.80, which relate to the notice of claim and notice of injury under the Wisconsin statutes. The trial court granted that motion, dismissed the case, and an appeal to the Court of Appeals followed. The Court of Appeals reviewed that trial court decision and made the determination that the requirements of Section 893.80 do not apply to federal constitutional claims. On that basis, the court sent the case back to the trial court. The reasoning of the Court of Appeals in the first decision, as I understand it, was that the court did not view the complaint as alleging state claims at all, and for that reason, the court determined that it didn't have to make a specific decision on the applicability of 893.80 as to any claims other than the federal claims. It simply viewed this case as a case alleging federal constitutional violations. So the procedural status then when the case went back was the trial court's judgment with regard to the state claims stood, and the federal claims were back at the trial court level to be addressed by the trial court. It was then later during the proceedings that the second motion for summary judgment was filed with regard to the due process and equal protection claims, And upon that decision, the case went back to the Court of Appeals and is now here before this court. And what the court has before it now is whether the plaintiffs may maintain at this stage of the proceedings claims for federal procedural due process, federal substantive due process, and federal equal protection. The due process claims are the subject of the Thorpe's appeal because the Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court in dismissing those claims.
But counsel, just as a matter of judicial economy, it seems inevitable that eventually the Thorpes are entitled to a decision on the notice, as the notice requirements of 893 as they relate to the state claims. Do you disagree with that?
No, I don't, Your Honor.
Then why shouldn't we decide it now?
My interpretation, and this court may disagree with that interpretation, my interpretation of the first appeal to the Court of Appeals is that the Court of Appeals agreed with our position as to the state law claims.
I didn't think they made any statement with respect to state law claims. They simply sent it back because they felt that this was a federal claim. In fact, that's what you just said.
I think you're correct, and I may have just misspoken. The Thorpes did get a decision from the trial court. So if this court finds that it's procedurally proper at this stage to be addressing that issue, then they are entitled to a decision.
Do you read this complaint as stating any state law claims at all?
Yes, I do.
And where would that be? I'm looking at the complaint in the record right now, and what I see are three claims contained in paragraph B, C, and D of the complaint, or sections B, C, and D of the complaint. Paragraph B is in caption, invalidity of town and county zoning ordinance, and the basis for that claim is constitutional. C is in caption, inverse condemnation, and the basis for that obviously is constitutional as well under the takings clause. And D is denial of plaintiff's right of a fair and impartial hearing, and the basis for that, again, by the terms of the complaint itself, is constitutional. And that's it.
I agree with Your Honor that there's little, if any, to consist of state law claims in the complaint, but there is a claim, as Mr. Kershak noted, under, I believe it's chapter 62 or 60, with regard to the number of members that are required on the town board. There are also, I believe, statements throughout the company. Excuse me.
But that's not a claim or a separate cause of action. That's part and parcel of the constitutional claim. What we basically have are a bunch of allegations, factual allegations, and legal allegations as to why the Constitution was violated in this procedure. And one of them is that the state law wasn't complied with about the number of...
16A.
Right, it's 16A, right. That's not a separate claim or cause of action. That's a reason why the plaintiffs are saying that this was a violation of due process, right?
I understand that point, and I think...
And that's apparently the point of view that the trial court and the Court of Appeals and the First Appeal adopted that reading of this complaint, right?
I believe you are correct, at least as to the Court of Appeals. I'm not sure what the trial court's interpretation on that point was. And I think one of the problems with this case from the beginning was that there were so many theories alleged in the complaint that it was hard to get a handle on exactly what was being claimed. I believe, without having the complaint in front of me right now, that the complaint also talks about the state constitution as well as the federal constitution.
It does, right in that paragraph, 16, in the preliminary. So that would be the basis of the state claim.
I believe it would, Your Honor. It
says, deprives the plaintiffs, goes through the litany, and deprives the plaintiffs of their property without due process or equal protection as set forth in the United States Constitution and state of Wisconsin Constitution. So, from your perspective, a state constitutional claim is a state claim.
Yes,
Your Honor. Counsel, let me try this. I think that there's no notice issue here at all. That, to the extent that the assertions are they're in violation of federal and state. You can just decide them under federal, and we don't have to reach the state issue. There's been some suggestion that, well, maybe become a declaratory judgment, you go under 804, that's a state statute. But that's just the remedy. The claim is still a constitutional claim. So I think maybe this is nothing but a bunch of smoke. And under the Casey case, we don't have a problem with notice of claim. We have federal constitutional issues. And there's no real notice issue in this case. Do you disagree with that?
I don't, as a matter of practicality. I think that we are here to address the federal claims, and based on the law of this case, the 89380 provisions do not apply to the federal claims, so we should proceed on the merits of those claims.
What about the cause of action in the first complaint calling this an inverse condemnation? Is that claim still alive?
No, it's not, Your Honor, and that was specifically determined to not state a claim by the Court of Appeals. The first appeal was not appealed further, and the law of the case now is that it's no longer in the case. It's not before the Court of Appeals.
If we go back to the beginning, let me ask this. Should the plaintiffs have filed under 59-99-10 or not?
As far as that specific statute, Your Honor, I wanted to get into that, and that relates to what remedies were available under a writ certiorari had that procedure been followed in this case. The statute, there is a statute, 59.694, and I believe that was formerly 59.99. That deals with situations where the county appoints a board of adjustment. In this case, the Thorpe's matter was heard by the entire county board, not by a board of adjustment. So we need to look a little bit beyond that specific statute. What we need to look to is section 68.13. That is the more general statute that talks about municipal administrative procedure and authorizes under 68.13 subdivision 1. It states, any party to a proceeding resulting in a final determination may seek review thereof by certiorari within 30 days of receipt of the final determination. The court may affirm or reverse the final determination or remand to the decision maker for further proceedings consistent with the court's decision.
Except, counsel, the determination in this case was an ordinance, wasn't it? Enacted by the board?
The
zoning ordinance?
The determination was the denial of the petition to rezone.
Okay. So the initial determination would have been the ordinance. And certiorari wouldn't lie from an ordinance decision.
I think that is correct.
But it's the petition to rezone that was heard by the entire board that
correct.
Was denied that constitutes a determination reviewable under the general administrative municipal review procedure.
Yes.
Okay. So there is statutory certiorari available. The Court of Appeals was wrong when it said that there wasn't and resorted to common law certiorari theories.
I believe that you're correct.
That's the position you're taking.
Yes, but the Court of Appeals did find that certiorari was an available remedy, so it's our position it was available under 68.13. It was also available under the common law. Now, a couple of things I'd like to note about review by certiorari. Number one, the procedure requires that the review be sought within 30 days of receipt of the final determination. In this case, the last act of the county that is alleged to have violated the Thorpe's rights took place on March 21st, 1995. This case was filed May 23rd, 1995, a little more than 60 days later. Therefore, even if the facts could be fit into a certiorari theory as the clerks now attempt to do. It still was not filed within 30 days. It did not comply with the certiorari procedure. Secondly, under a certiorari review, the Kapischke case that the Thorpes have cited at 226 Wisconsin 2nd, 320, discusses the scope of certiorari review and what that entails. There are four enumerated areas that the court looks at on a certiorari review. The third of those is whether its action, it being the municipality, was arbitrary, oppressive, or unreasonable. We believe that that was an available remedy for the constitutional claims that are being now alleged. And because the plaintiffs did not avail themselves of that remedy, they cannot now make the claim that they're making. It was based on that availability of a state law remedy that the Court of Appeals agreed with the dismissal of the procedural due process claim. And it's our belief that even if a due process claim could be brought as a matter of procedure, that the factual allegations still do not meet the requirements for a due process claim. And that is because zoning is a legislative function, and we do not believe the allegations that are in the complaint rise to the level of a due process violation. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about substantive due process. The Court of Appeals quoted extensively from a case of the United States Supreme Court called County of Sacramento versus Lewis at 118 Supreme Court Reporter 1708. And the court said in that case that substantive due process protects against the exercise of power by the government without any reasonable justification in the service of a governmental objective. And where there is an abuse of executive power claimed, the court applies a shock the conscience standard. And where there is a legislative act, such as we have here, the court in the Sacramento case said it's reluctant to expand substantive due process, and where there is a specific constitutional provision that applies, that is going to be the guide rather than the generalized concept of substantive due process. Now, the Court of Appeals in this case noted that there is a substantial dispute in the federal courts over whether substantive due process can ever be the basis for challenging land use regulations. And I have more that I can say about that issue, but I don't want to run out of time and not address the equal protection issue, so I think I'm going to turn to that. That's the subject of our cross appeal. And the Court of Appeals found, first of all, that the factual allegations of the complaint were sufficient to state a claim, and that, secondly, that state law remedies do not preclude an equal protection claim in this case. We disagree with the conclusion of the Court of Appeals. First of all, to the extent that the plaintiffs are relying on the general allegation that the zoning in question is arbitrary or unreasonable, there is a state law remedy for that. That's the certiorari review remedy. And as I noted, one of the criteria the court looks at in a certiorari review is whether the board's action was arbitrary, oppressive, or unreasonable. Arbitrariness is the claim being made here. The plaintiffs could have claimed in a certiorari proceeding that the county's refusal to grant their rezoning request was arbitrary, oppressive, or unreasonable, but they did not avail themselves of that remedy. The Bueller case at 33 Wisconsin 2nd at page 143, decided by this court, noted that an attack based on the arbitrariness or unreasonableness of a legislative action is the equivalent of a claim of unconstitutionality based on a denial of equal protection of the laws or due process. I raise that just to say it is substantially equivalent to what they could have obtained by certiorari. Secondly, under equal protection analysis, we do not believe the complaint alleges facts that are sufficient to make out a claim.
Can I stop you a second, counsel, before
yes.
you get off at this point? Assuming you're correct that there are adequate state remedies that they simply failed to avail themselves of, isn't that another issue, which is whether or not the availability of adequate state remedies is a necessary prerequisite to an equal protection claim?
In this case, I don't think there is another issue, and that is because the whole basis of the equal protection claim in this case is a general claim of arbitrariness. If there were a claim of intentional discrimination based on the plaintiff's membership in a particular class or of malice or something of that nature, then you would have a different situation. And in that situation, I don't think they would have had an available state remedy. So this ties in with our claim that the complaint does not allege something that gives rise to an equal protection claim. This is the complaint as it relates to equal protection from paragraph 16C of the complaint. Some of the land that has kept its rural development classification is even more suitable for agriculture and farming than the plaintiff's own property. That is essentially what the equal protection claim is in this case, and we believe that even if that's assumed to be true, that does not make out a violation of equal protection. The law requires more than that. For example, in the New Burnham Prairie Homes case decided by the Seventh Circuit in 1990 at 910 F. 2nd 1474 at page 1481, the court said, a person bringing an action under the Equal Protection Clause must show intentional discrimination against him because of his membership in a particular class, not merely that he was treated unfairly as an individual. The decision maker must have selected or reaffirmed a particular course of action, at least in part because of, not merely in spite of, its adverse effects upon an identifiable group. Have is a claim of general unfairness of the zoning and of the denial of the petition to rezone. We do not have a claim that because the plaintiffs were members of a particular class, they were treated differently. I see that my time is up.
Could you just state directly why it is that the Thorpes violated 89380.
Your Honor, I did not anticipate arguing this point in detail today, but my best recollection, which I believe to be accurate based on the record, is that there are two subdivisions that need to be complied with. One is the notice of injury under 89381A, and the second is notice of claim under 893.801B. I believe what they did not comply with specifically is 893.801B, which requires the claimant to make an itemized statement of the relief sought. And the reason that is a requirement is so that the municipality has an opportunity to evaluate the claim that's being made and to determine whether some attempt should be made to resolve it. That was not done in this case. There was only a generalized statement that that their land is worth less than it was worth before because of the current zoning. And the county had no opportunity to try to resolve the matter, and that's the purpose behind that prong of 89380.
So,
So your position is that Dodge County was did not have any actual notice of what they were concerned about?
Dodge County obviously had significant notice that the Thorpes were dissatisfied about the zoning. What they didn't have was a number in terms of damages that the Thorpes would settle for example. This case involves a claim for damages, and that is one clear area where the notice was sufficient.
You concede that notice of claim is not required in the case of constitutional claims?
Yes.
And also in the case of certiorari?
Yes. And let me just state, if I may, under certiorari, the reasoning given in the Kopischke case that the notice wouldn't apply to a certiorari proceeding was that the certiorari proceeding has to be brought within 30 days, and that would be inconsistent with the procedure under 8N38.
Where you had 120.
Correct.
Right. What about state constitutional claims? Notice of claim apply?
I believe it does, yes. And that is because the case law has held that 89380 applies to all claims, not just claims for money damages. So I think that would include state constitutional claims. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
To please the court, my name is Michael Sezulowitz. I represent the town of Lebanon in this matter. I've been with this case now for 5 years since it was filed, and I must say I am totally confused. At no time in the court below, in any of the courts below, did the plaintiffs argue that this was a writ of certiorari case. On the first summary judgment motion, they argued, in fact, just the opposite to try to convince the court they didn't have to satisfy the notice of claim statute. And when it went up on appeal, they continued that argument. The 1997 decision of the Court of Appeals, on page 2, footnote 1, the Court of Appeals notes, we do not understand the Thorpes to argue that their complaint contains any state law claim. Now, it was only after the second motions for summary judgment and their federal claims came under attack that they began to say they had state law claims.
I recognize that, and yet when the Court of Appeals did this on the first case, then that footnote said, we don't see the state law claim. But as I understand the record, when it came back down, the first motion that you people made, that the defendants made, was to dismiss this on grounds of lack of notice.
No, when it came back down after the first appeal, we filed summary judgment motions saying that there were no claims stated in the complaint for federal constitutional violations for due process or for equal protection. And one of the arguments on the due process was that the reason there was no federal claim stated is because they had not exhausted state remedies.
And you did not base any of your arguments the first time, the second time around based on 893-80?
We did not, but the plaintiff then tried to bring that up and say that they still had state law claims to be brought outside of their federal claims on the second time around. But our second motions for summary judgment really went, I think Justice Bradley is correct on this, her assertion that what this case is really about now, as we sit here today, are what are left of the federal constitutional claims, either for due process, whether it be procedural or substantive, or equal protection. That's what we're really here to talk about. And on that point, as far as the town of Lebanon is concerned, I would like to stress really just two points. The town of Lebanon does not have and has never had its own zoning. It relies on county zoning and has done so since April 1969. And second, the town of Lebanon did in fact vote in favor of the Thorpe's request for rezoning. Now in this process, we can go through how we got here today. In this process, I think the Thorpes had two chances to challenge what the municipality and the county had done. The original zoning here, the county zoning, was adopted by the town board and the town meeting in April 1969. That can be done under statute section 60.62, sub 2. A town adopts county zoning. another section of the statute, 59.69 sub 5E3, gives the town not a right of veto, but says the town, if there's an amendment to a zoning, the town can indicate by resolution or town board action whether or not it disapproves of the proposed zoning amendment. But the final ultimate decision on zoning is still at the county board under 60.62 sub 3. So what happened here is we have county zoning since 1969, and in the 1990s, the town of Lebanon, like a lot of towns, started to discuss whether or not it would be beneficial to have a land use plan. And so they went to the county, and they actually contracted with the county and said, we would like to use your staff, your county planning and development staff, to help us develop a plan, a comprehensive plan for the town. At the same time, they appointed, the town board appointed, a three-citizen committee, a planning committee, to work with the county. They did a survey. They created a comprehensive plan in 1994 for the town. And part of the plan also included a change in the zoning map so that the zoning would then comport with the comprehensive plan for the development of the town. At that point, they then went to the county and said, okay, let's adopt the zoning map. Let's change the zoning. The board couldn't do that. The county had to do it. But on July 7, 1994, the board recommended to the county that they change the zoning map. On October 18, 1994, the county board did act and did change the zoning map. Now, Justice Sykes brought up, well, that's not subject to writ of certiorari review, and that's right. But it is subject to a lawsuit. They could have brought a lawsuit under 59.69 sub 14. That gives the person who is aggrieved, the landowner aggrieved, by a change in zoning because of a faulty procedure or use of a statute or ordinance, 6 months to sue. Set that aside. So if they felt that there was this blanket zoning or some other problem under 59.69 sub 14, plaintiffs had 6 months to bring a lawsuit from October 18, 1994. They didn't do that. They didn't start this lawsuit until May of 95, more than 6 months later. Instead, that was their first chance in a state remedy to rectify the problem if they felt the actual zoning ordinance was wrong. Instead, what they did, and I don't really criticize them for this, but they brought a petition or a request before the town board and said, look, change our zoning back to what we had before. Not all the land, just 155 of the 255 acres. Change it back. That came before the town board only 3 or 4 months after the zoning had been changed. That came before the town board February 28, 1995. And the town board agreed. The town board agreed 2-1 on a vote and said, we will change it back to what your zoning was before. But the town board doesn't have power to do that. It goes to the county, and there's where the county board said no. Now, our argument in our brief as to the town is really, you can call it exhaustion remedies, you can call it ripeness, you can call it whatever you want. But the fact of the matter is, in the federal cases on ripeness, they say that a state authority should be given a chance to arrive at or find or make a definitive position in regard to the regulation at issue. The town board did that in February of 95 when it voted to give the folks what they wanted. And our position is whether you call this due process because of procedure or due process because of substance or equal protection, either way, the federal case law is clear. You still need that causal nexus between the constitutional deprivation causing some injury. Well, if the town voted 2-1 to give them what they want, how can there ever be a causal nexus between that deprivation, if there was one, which we don't admit necessarily there was, but assuming for this argument there was, and whatever injury the Thorpes happened to them?
It's been a week since I read the Court of Appeals opinion. Did they lift this argument of yours that, hey, our hands are clean?
They did, right at the end, in about a page and a half, and they said that they didn't feel that the argument we presented to them in the briefs had really spelled out this issue for them. In our briefs in this court, we point out that we believe we did. We cited the Taylor case and one or two other state court cases for that proposition that, in terms of this causal nexus, they should have considered that. For whatever reason, the Court of Appeals just sort of jumped over that issue. I think in terms of, if you want to call it ripeness or whatever, if we look at a simple hypothetical, let's assume there was no county zoning here. It was all town zoning. And the town changed the plaintiff's zoning when they redid this map, and the plaintiffs then come before them and say, well, change our zoning back. And the town grants it and says 2-1, yeah, we change it back. If there was no county zoning, that would be the end of it. Could the town then be sued for having changed it back and giving them what they wanted? It doesn't seem to make sense that they should be under a ripeness argument, because they had the opportunity to make the final definitive position, and if there was an error, to change that error, and they did. So under those circumstances, we believe that the Court of Appeals erred here, and I believe really should rule as a matter of law, because there can be no cause of damages or injury, that the town should be out of this case.
Could I ask you a question? I think you said that after the county board had rezoned the property upon the request of the town, that the Thorpes had a remedy under 59-69-14, and that they had 6 months.
I believe it's 180 days.
180 days to act on that.
Right.
Instead of acting, they went back to the town and did all sorts of things, and then they went back to the board, to the county board.
And
that final action of the board was March 21st, 1995.
Yes.
Are you saying that they no longer had any authority to sue pursuant to 59-69-14 at that point?
Yes, because 59.69-14 is a limitation statute that contains a 180-day limitation for bringing an action to challenge the type of procedures the plaintiffs are now talking about. For example, they say we should have appointed a 5-person zoning board. Well, that is a statutory procedure which, if it wasn't firm, they should have challenged within that 6 months period. They didn't do it. He talks about blanket zoning as being somehow improper here. Well, if that was a violation of ordinance or statute, they should have sued under 59.69 within that 6 months period to challenge.
So they should have sued before trying to go back to the county board and get it fixed?
They probably could have done both. They probably could have done both. They could have tried to set aside the entire ordinance if they truly believed there was a statutory violation here. They could have, I suppose, at the same time, gone to the county board and said, look, we're going to start this lawsuit to claim that what you did here was statutorily impermissible. But what we really want you to do is change our zoning back. We could have made that request to them.
Is it fair to punish them for trying to work through the system?
No, not at all, but they made their choice. They could have sued to set aside the entire ordinance, which they didn't do. Then they brought their request for a change, and they got a decision not favorable to them in, as you pointed out, March 95. I believe from that point they had 30 days to file a writ of certiorari appeal to the circuit court. They didn't do that. They didn't start their lawsuit until May of 1995. And I don't know, but I suspect that one of the reasons that there are so many of these constitutional words in that complaint is that there are some statute of limitations problems here. And the federal 1983 action has a 6-year statute of limitations by court interpretation. So they're well within bringing a claim, a federal claim under constitutional law, but I think they were out of luck on the state statute of limitations, both at 59.69 after writ of certiorari appeal.
Thank you.
See, my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kerchick, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Justice Seitz, I'd like to just respond to a question that you asked opposing counsel about where the language in the complaint is that states state law claims. If you go back to the first cause of action, we do set forth in paragraph 16 of our complaint that we felt that the present classification of the plaintiff's property prohibiting its use from rural development is, quote, arbitrary, discriminatory, and unreasonable. Now, it's my understanding under the case of Maris versus the city of Cedarburg that that's the standard to grant a review under a writ of certiorari, and that's where that language came from. It goes both to the constitutional violations as well as the writ of certiorari. And then if you will turn to the wherefore clause of our...
Does it go to the state constitution?
I think it goes to the state and the federal constitution. And if you go to our wherefore clause of our complaint, you'll see that in paren A on the last page, we're asking for a state remedy under 806.04, seeking a declaratory judgment from the circuit court that the zoning ordinance is adopted by both the town and the county is unconstitutional, but more importantly, null and void and unenforceable as applied to the plaintiff's real estate. And in paren B, we're asking for an injunction. Now, those are state remedies. Those are part of our state claims.
But those aren't separate state law claims, as that term is understood in our law of civil procedure. That's a procedural device that is used to litigate a constitutional claim.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by setting forth specific state law claims. These are the claims under state common law and the state statute under 16 paren A that we think we had. You're asking me a question like the trial court asked me, where you didn't pursue your state law claims. Well, these are our state law claims. They are set forth in our complaint.
Actually, your state law claims were to take a writ of certiorari, right?
Which we did. Our complaint was our writ.
Now you're contending that that's what this was. But that's not what it was in caption, and that's not what anybody in the trial court argued. Or you could have taken this other statutory claim as a challenge to the enactment of the ordinance in the first place because it wasn't done pursuant to the requirements of the statute. Those were your two state law claims, apart from any constitutional claims you have, state or federal, correct? I mean, your state law claims are basically, they didn't follow the statutory procedure for enacting this ordinance, right?
That's correct.
And the state law way to challenge that is this, the statute that contains in the municipal code, 5969 sub 14. There's your state law claim, your remedy for that sort of a legal violation of the law is to file within, a lawsuit within 6 months challenging it. You didn't do that, but instead you tried to, as Justice Prosser said, work through the system,
right,
and you petitioned for rezoning, which you could certainly do, but then once that was denied, the way that you remedy that under the statutes or the common law is certiorari, and you didn't do that either. This is what the defense is arguing, and instead you filed a constitutional case and are now trying to characterize that as a state law claim.
That's what they're arguing, but I disagree with their analysis of the time limits. First of all, this is the first I've heard of the time limits. I don't think these were raised on the trial court level, nor were they raised in the Court of Appeals, nor were they raised in the briefs that were filed. I don't think Section 68.13 was raised, nor was the time limit raised under 59.694. But I'll tell you that under 59.69 paren 14, the six-month time limit, if you look at that statute, it says from the date of resolution. Now, there were two resolutions in this case. One was when the ordinance was passed by Dodge County. One was when they rejected our rezoning request. And my theory is under 59.69 paren 14, that's when our time limit started to run to file our state law claim, because we've tried to exhaust our state remedies. And the decision by Dodge County was, denying the Thorpe's request for rezoning was done on March 21st, 1995. Our complaint was filed on May 23rd, 1995, within 2 months after that. I'd like to also respond to the claim of the Dodge County that procedural due process doesn't necessarily apply here because of the standards. I think that there are circuit courts that disagree with what the standard should be. We have the Eternalist Foundation case, which sets the standard as shocking to the conscience of the court. And I think what happened on the town level and the Dodge County level is shocking to the conscience of the court, where you have blanket rezoning without any difference to the land and the nature of the land, where you have wetlands and floodplains zoned general agricultural, when you have lands that are more suitable to agricultural use than the Thorpes that are still rural development. The fact that they ignored our affidavits of four farmers, 65 residents, I think that's all shocking to the conscience of the court. And I think that it's something that you can consider in finding a due process violation.
But that all goes to the merits, doesn't it? And this case, which has been dismissed twice now, as you observed in your principal argument, on procedural technicalities, basically, right?
On many different reasons.
The merits have never been heard. You may have an outstanding case on the merits, either under certiorari or under the statutory review procedure when the ordinance is enacted in violation of the statutory procedures, or on your constitutional claims, right. But nobody's ever been able to get to those because of the procedural requirements that haven't been followed.
And those procedural requirements are what we just discussed, is that correct?
Well, that's what I'm suggesting, that all the arguments have been procedural in nature, and had those procedures been followed properly, maybe the merits would have been heard in the trial court.
Well, I think that the procedures have been followed, and I think they were proper. Despite that, we had our complaint dismissed twice. As a final comment, let me just comment on the equal protection claim of the town of Lebanon.
The only one you stand a chance of winning on, according to the Court of Appeals.
Pardon?
The only one you stand a chance of winning on, the Court of Appeals.
That's right. That's the only life they've given us, yes.
Right.
Right. Equal protection claim. And
you want to hang on to it?
I would like to. Yes, I would. If you would not like me to address it, I could stop right now.
Go ahead, but you've got a couple of seconds.
Okay. Very, very briefly, Your Honor. The town of Lebanon would like to wash its hands because they did vote in favor of the Thorpes, and they gave the Thorpes what they wanted. But all I ask you to do is keep in mind that it was initially the impetus of the town that requested this rezoning. It was the impetus of the town that asked Dodge County's assistance in taking all the rural development land and turning it into general agricultural. It was the insistence of the town to adopt the zoning ordinance that they adopted. Now they're trying to wash their hands of all that, and I don't think that's appropriate. And I think that they should stay in this suit as an indispensable party, because any ruling the court makes is going to affect the town of Lebanon one way or the other. In addition to that, there's nothing to stop the town of Lebanon from going back and revisiting this issue on their own and rezoning the Thorpes' land back to general agricultural. So I think they're a proper party, and I think because they were the ones who started this whole chain of events, they should be kept into the suit, and they're responsible for the same types of violations that we've alleged. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court's in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.